Hey, what happened to the music? Welcome, gang. Welcome to National Bugle Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, the home of free speech. And also, you know my routine. Okay, so we'll just get through it. Go to republicbroadcasting.org. Click on the donate button, send shekels. Go to, what's my website? nationalbugle.com. And download the Kosher Certified app. Start living a non-kosher certified lifestyle. I was eating a non-kosher certified sandwich just now. I thought the music was going to go on a little bit longer, but anyway, there you go. This is a live show. It is a live call-in show. We will take your calls at 1-800-313-9443, 1-800-313-9443. And we already have our first caller. It is Jeremy from Kentucky. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Talk to Spidery. I'm out walking the dog, Mr. S, and we're doing a little break from work. Had to take a break from all that painting. Had something important to call in to National Bugle.
Okay, well, what do you have to report to us today, Jeremy?
Well, it's something we didn't get to cover on our Tuesday Not Recorded show that aired yesterday. But, you know, some details have been coming out about this Kobe Bryant crash. And I'm sure, just like me, everybody's tired of hearing about Kobe Bryant. When they told me that he died, I'm like, yeah, the basketball guy? Yeah, so I could care less about sports or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody at these churches are talking about it and, like, having prayer vigils. It's kind of crazy. But there's some details that have come out now that the investigators have been on the scene. And this is kind of highlighting what has affirmative action and, you know, third world pilots and air traffic controllers, what is it doing, you know, to our society? And some things that I just wanted to address, and maybe this will spark some interest mm-hmm. in other callers commenting on this. But so for one thing, the pilot, Kobe Bryant's pilot, and I had the name. I'll see that if I can pull it up. But he basically had like a broken accident. He was a I can't tell what nationality he was from, but like the day that they took off, like they had no business being in the air. Very foggy day.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a special, you know, licensing that these pilots have to have, and they have to have, you know, regular training in order to fly in conditions like this with these low-level aircraft, basically where they fly instrument only, and which is very hard to do and takes a very, very skilled pilot. Now, I'm not a pilot.
What's that? Intimate only?
Instrument only.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, basically you're in the air and you can't see the horizon. You can't, you know, see any highways or interstates or any markers. Now, keep in mind, this is for lower level. You know, most commercial airliners, they fly instrument only, you know, because of the high altitude and the conditions that they fly in. But this dropper pilot, I mean, it takes very experienced pilot to fly like this, because you can lose all your sense of direction up there and crash very easily. It's very hard to rely only on your instruments. So there's the one thing. They took off on a day where it required instrument-only flight. Now, this mm-hmm. pilot was certified, mm-hmm. But other pilots that knew him were questioning, like, his experience level.
And do we know what country he was from?
I sent you two articles. Now, I'm on the phone, and I'm outside. Okay. I can't pull it. If we were on Skype, I'd be right on top of that, pulling that article up. But I couldn't get the article. The second article that I sent you focuses on the pilot himself. And even though he had the certification to fly without instruments, he did not invoke that. When he took off, he basically flew in a limited status. So there's the one thing. Another thing to consider while you're looking up the pilot's name, because it's really weird, starts with a Z, another thing to consider is that this particular chopper, this particular aircraft, not chopper, this aircraft is a luxury aircraft. And because it has extra things on it, and there's a max allowable takeoff weight, it's a gross max takeoff weight, I think it was right around 12,000 pounds. It was a little under, between 11 and 12,000 pounds, this takeoff weight. They could only have six passengers. So you could have pilot, a co-pilot, and then six passengers. Well, there were two extra passengers on this aircraft. So they're your weights off. Now, you know, one could say, well, maybe they didn't have a topped off fuel. Maybe they didn't have, you know, max out on their luggage, but still you only have six seat belts. That's the main thing. And something in aviation to remember is that if you do get into a situation where you have to maneuver, every little 5 to 10 pounds counts, and where it's positioned on the aircraft counts. Because if you have six seat belts and eight people, there's two people that are able to move around. Should maneuvering happen, and they could move around inadvertently, or they could be up walking around, nervous, pacing, jumping up and down. And that's going to affect every little movement on an aircraft that size. There's another thing to consider. So they had two extra passengers. They were flying in conditions they shouldn't have been, and the pilot is said to have been inexperienced in flying instrument only. And I was also able to hear, and you can look this, you just have to Google it, you can get audio of the air traffic controllers talking to Kobe Bryant's pilot. And basically this guy sounded like he was just out in Rio Rhinelander. He just sounded lost. And just a few minutes before the crash, they were telling him, like, you're too low. You are too low. And then that was it. So what seems to have happened was he got disoriented and he just flying at low level altitude and ran right into that hill.
Mm-hmm.
So did you catch the name of the pilot? Have you found it in the article?
Yeah. So, and I've seen a photograph of him. He looks Middle Eastern. He may well be Israeli. I'm not sure. Ara Zobayan. Now, it's Zobayan, Zobay. I don't have a grip on that. So we'll get it. But he certainly he looks Middle Eastern. And you said you were able to hear his voice?
Yes. Very broken English. I couldn't find anything on the pilot. Like, there's a lot of stuff that they're hiding. Like, basically, they're trying to blame the FAA. They're saying, oh, the helicopter was 30 years old. Well, it had very low flying hours. And, you know, that's 30, 40 years old. That's about average for some of these things. You know, aircraft is very expensive, no matter what it is. It's designed to fly many hours and have inspections done on it. All the parts are supposed to be top quality, and it's a higher grade. So the fact that it was 30 years old, that's really not a factor here. The factors, like we pointed out, is the extra two passengers, the inexperience of the pilot, flying instrument only, you know, and then, you know, this pilot's most likely, I don't know anything about him, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say he was not born in America, and that you know, perhaps
Armenian
he was...
Armenian descent. I was wondering about that. Armenian. All right, so I don't know.
This all brings up a bigger question, and just keep an eye on your call panel, because I don't want to take up anyone else's time. I just thought it would be interesting to throw this out there. You know, it was just a few years ago that Obama lowered the qualifications to get affirmative action into air traffic control. And Farron show
which was,
yeah.
That was on featured on Tucker's show, and it really was kind of an outrage. They changing the questions and changing the grading to things that were completely irrelevant to what you would think would be a qualification for being air traffic controller. In order to make it easier for non-whites, for blacks in particular, to gain that status.
Yeah, absolutely. Tucker did cover that, and Farron Shoaf covered it extensively on the alternative media on his show. I think it was last summer. May have been the year before that, but I know Farron covered it. And then we had most recently, probably what, early last year, middle of last year, Boeing has the new aircraft out, the 737 MAX. It's designed to, it's got more powerful engines, take off faster, climb, you know, get altitude faster. And there's a safety mechanism on this aircraft the mechanism would, by computer, assist the aircraft in takeoffs. And in order to disable this, you have to, flip a switch. You basically have to have special training on where the switch is and what the procedure is to disable this. Because what was happening was, you know, when the aircraft was sold to the third world, their pilots didn't receive sufficient training. They were not flipping the switch off. And the aircraft would take off, and they wanted to do a manual change, and they would fight against the aircraft, and they would crash it. And so, you know, once again, you know, the global media comes out and says, oh, we need to recall this airplane and safety feature, and Boeing needs to do this. Well, the thing about it is that Boeing offered extensive classes to train pilots on the safety feature, and the third world pilots didn't take them. So, again, I think the whole point that I'm trying to bring up here with Kobe Bryant and the crash is that we're reaching levels of, you know, third worlders in positions they shouldn't be, that shouldn't even be possible here. And not because we hate anybody, but because, look, I mean, you know, talking about air traffic controllers and pilots, you know, thousands of lives in danger here. What if Bryant's plane would have crashed in the neighborhood? I mean, the thing made a crater in the hill and the tail, like, and debris scattered 500 to 600 feet. So, I mean, this thing hit hard, and they could easily have crashed and killed many, many people. So, something I wanted to bring up.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, I was, the day before the crash was the day that LeBron James, the King, had passed Kobe Bryant and become the third highest scorer in NBA sports ball history. So Bryant was a little bit in the news that day, and I know that when Bryant was about 22 years old, 22, 23, there was a woman who accused him of rape. But, you know, very young, very rich superstar athletes are targets. And so I really don't put a whole lot of weight into that. As far as superstar sports ball athletes are concerned, he seemed to be I mean, I was not a fan. I watched basketball, and I wasn't a fan of the way he played in particular. But he was good. He was good, but I was never really a fan. But you know, he spoke Italian. He'd grown up partly in Italy because his father was playing sports ball over there, and he actually was reasonably well spoken. And as Tucker remarked, the morning of the demise, he was flying from. We knew he was flying to his daughter's basketball game or basketball practice where he was going to coach his daughter's team. But he was also flying from communion services. I guess he was a Roman Catholic or maybe Episcopalian, but he had gone like 7 a.m. to some early morning communion. So it seemed to be, you know, in as far as sports ball stars are concerned, he seemed to be a family man and, you know, trying to do the right thing. And, you know, even if he wasn't, I still don't like to see people crash and die. It's interesting about, you know, the pilot, and we are lowering standards, all sorts of standards, because multiculturalism has become just the highest value in our society. And so we're lowering standards everywhere, directly and indirectly. And you mentioned the air traffic controllers, but, you know, when you lower, when you have affirmative action into so many different jobs, into universities, you are not going to have a meritocracy. You're not going to have the most qualified people in positions. And, you know, and maybe having an HR person at a company or a computer programmer not being the most qualified, maybe it's not going to result in the fiery deaths of half a dozen people, but maybe it will. I mean, you never know. All jobs can be important in one way or another. So,
go ahead, Patrick.
Oh, I was going to say, we do have William on the line, and I know I want to get to William, but
Let me make my last point, and I'll let you and William kick it around, because I got to get back to painting. You mentioned Kobe Bryant probably was one of the best of the sports stars out there, but, like, first of all, like, you don't just flaunt, like, regulations like this, like putting more people on an aircraft than what's supposed to have. And then what kind of pilot was this that allowed this to happen? Like, when you get into like American pilots, like 90% of our pilots and air traffic controllers have Air Force experience,
right,
or some kind of military experience in aviation. And it was a time when air traffic controller required you to have military experience, period. And then I know our Air Force pilots are very disciplined, very by the book. And when they go into the civilian world, that translates. And that pilot should have said, whoa, whoa, we're not doing this. We're not doing, you know, eight passengers. That should have happened right there.
Yeah.
And, you know, but unless you're an emergency aircraft, you shouldn't have been flying in that. I wanted to leave you guys with that. And I want to let you and William kick it around. And I'm going to get back to work and just listen. Thanks for taking my call.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for the call. Okay,
right,
next we will jump over to William from Montana. William, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Patrick.
Hey, thanks for calling, William. So,
yep.
Edify us.
Well, you know, in keeping with the theme that I keep returning to, I've been spending a lot of time watching what's happening in Russia and also watching what's happening with Putin around the world. And I've given a lot of thought to, you know, how do you go about explaining what has happened? Like if your audience is predominantly from the United States, how do you even begin to talk about what has happened and why when, you know, it's the politics of geopolitics of Russia is so sort of fact-based and also performance-based, accomplishment-based, you know, result-based, and so, and then also there's very United States that really has any understanding of, first, how the whole Russian government functions, the different parts, and they also don't have very much history about what has happened, and they have been, you know, subjected to a lot of misinformation in the whole Russiangate type, you know, litany that really just keeps repeating all types of things, which becomes established as fact. And so I've really thought about, you know, just how do you even go about explaining some of this stuff that happened? And there was very significant change that happened, you know, in the last 3-4 weeks in Russia, and in order to understand it, you really have to do in some of these myths about, you know, what was happening and who was what, and, you know, like one of the, you know, like I was a little bit shocked that these changes and these proposals to the changes in the Constitution. I was a little bit shocked that it happened during that meeting. I wasn't, you know, unduly shocked about what happened, because if you were following, you would find out that a lot of these changes were in the works, and in particular, Medvedev, you know, his resigning, this sent a lot of shocks.
Yeah. Okay. Can you hold on to after the break?
Sure, yeah.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing, knowledge. and knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
TalkRight, the conservative app offered by TalkStream Live that caters exclusively to the conservative talk radio community. Here you'll see only talk shows and podcasts from the conservative right, all the big broadcast names and online digital shows in one place. TalkRight makes it easy to find all your favorite conservative talkers with all the upscale features you come to expect from TalkStream Live. Keep up with the fast-paced political world. Download TalkRight today from Google Play or the App Store.
Hey, is that a new music app?
Yeah, check it out, Surfer Music Discovery. It links to thousands of online stations, but the twist is you see the song names and artists that are now playing live.
That's different. No guessing. Looks like a waterfall of music.
So many formats. Rock, oldies, country, R&B, jazz, and a whole lot more.
How's that spelled?
Surfer, S-U-R-F-R.
Is it expensive?
It's free. No need to sign up or sign in.
Get the Surfer Music app free from Google Play or the App Store.
Show, National Beagle Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, and it's Patrick Slattery with William from Montana, and William is our resident Russia expert, and lots is going on there, and I will have a few follow-up questions for you, but you've been explaining about the recent shakeup in the Russian government.
Yeah, and, you know, the details are very complex. I mean, one of the things that I found very interesting was after the government, after Putin's announcement of these changes and proposals, the government resigned, and that was played up real big in the Western press as he's kicking the government out. But this resignation was definitely pre-planned, and it was in keeping with the current constitution. That's what happens in order to clear the boards for these proposals to be considered and a new government put in place. They resigned, but they still kept in their offices until replacements were found. It wasn't like they walked out the door. And I saw a couple of Western press announcements that, there was a big shakeup and they were rebelling against Putin taking over as the new czar, and all this ridiculousness. So there's a lot of interesting things. The fallout of this was that there were people who stayed and people who didn't. And that gets pretty complex.
Now, the most important person, at least to foreigners in that cabinet, was Sergei Lavrov, and he's remaining, correct?
Yes, and he's I almost wrote a letter to the Kremlin, and you can do that, saying, please keep Lavrov, because I think Lavrov is probably one of the greatest statesmen in existence. And I shouldn't have worried about that because, he was retained, and he has considerable respect, probably close to that of Putin's in terms of what he's done for Russia. But the big thing was Medvedev. You know, he left, and a lot of people said, well, wait a minute. Wasn't he being groomed to take over in 2024? I mean, wasn't he just the, you know, the go-to guy? I mean, wasn't it already planned that he was going to take over?
Because he's the person who had been, you might call it, the seat warmer during the 4 years that that Vladimir Putin was term limited out of the presidency and you know, took on the prime minister. They switched jobs, going from prime minister to president and then back to prime minister again.
And there was a big following in Russia, not a large following, but a significant following in Russia that really felt that if you were pro-Western and pro-leaning towards additional cooperation and joining a lot of globalist structures and stuff like that, you really, as a liberal, you really were had hopes that when Medvedev took over, that there would be a real liberalization of the government, because, you know, he's a younger, he's an attorney, he's very non-confrontational, but all of this really didn't sit well with the majority of Russian people, who really felt that he was kind of lackluster and sort of sitting on the fence too many times when he should have taken more definitive action.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I looked over my notes, it was, you know, I knew that was going to happen. Now, not many people, you know, could say that. You know, a lot of people thought that he was like a permanent fixture because, you know, like you pointed out, I mean, he's, you know, a high-standing member in the largest political party in Russia. And so everyone thought, you know, like, you know, comparing it to the West, that, oh, if you're one of the shining lights in the party, doesn't the party choose this, and wouldn't he just naturally take the place? But, you know, when I looked over my notes, I mean, there were times back in 2011 when there was rumors that he was going to be asked to resign just because of his lack of charisma.
So in 2011, at the time, he was the president.
Yeah.
Was the idea that after his term, then he would be asked to leave?
Yeah, they were thinking that when Putin was reelected, he would definitely choose a new prime minister.
Mm-hmm. Hey,
because,
I have a quick question
before
the break. So Medvedev, he's reasonably young. I guess he's early 50s or something. But he had been some sort of functionary in Yeltsin's political party, I'm pretty sure. And yet, according to Stephen F. Cohen, Medvedev acknowledged or confirmed to foreign journalists that the 1996 election was in fact stolen by Yeltsin from the actual winner, which was Communist Party's Gennady Zyuganov. Have you ever heard anything about that?
Yeah, that, you know, it was, there was so much, is that the music? There was so much.
Yeah, it's the music, so we'll hear about that after the break.
Good, all right.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Hey, honey, I'm home. I grabbed the newspaper on the way home. Look at all the news today.
The newspaper? Don't you know that all you're going to get in the newspaper is propaganda, twisted news, and false information?
Honey, this is a national newspaper. It has to be true.
Ha! For some reason, a majority of the population believe anything the mainstream media tells them. The newspaper does not give out the important attention on what's happening to this country and news that affects our daily lives. Say, does that newspaper mention anything about the North American Union?
No, not that I can see.
I didn't think so. You need to go to www.newswithviews.com. where truth is more important than political correctness. That's www.newswithviews.com. Hey, don't throw that away. We can use that in the birdcage.
Okay, move over. Let me start reading newswithviews.com.
The truth? Read all about it at newswithviews.com. Newswithviews.com, where reality shatters illusion.
February is Heart Month. Every year for the month of February, to show our appreciation to Extendivite's faithful customers, we have a sale. If you would like to try Extendivite, now is the time to get a few months ahead and really give Extendivite the time to show you how it works. Most of Extendivite's long-term customers wait for this sale to stock up. People and doctors tell us about the unbelievable improvements that they have experienced in their overall health, not just the heart. Extendivite wants you to experience the power of these herbs. Get a four-month supply for only $115 for either the capsules or tincture. Please take advantage of this once-per-year sale and get healthy for life. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com or find us on Amazon.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
How would you like to earn an extra $10,000 or more a month from the comfort of your home? We show you how to win with a home-based business opportunity. This could be one of the best financial decisions you ever make. Work from home, full-time or part-time. Plus, you'll never have to talk to anyone. Our professional sales team closes all your sales for you, and you keep 70% of all the sales made. You could be earning money while you're sleeping, shopping, working out, wherever you are, day or night. Our system goes to work for you. You can make a great income without any special computer skills or sales training. Plus, you get paid fast, within just 24 to 48 hours after our professional sales team closes a sale for you. Let us help you eliminate your financial concerns. You could be earning enough money to pay off debt, buy a house, a car, or whatever the case may be. We've got you covered. If you'd like to add an extra $10,000 or more a month to your portfolio, and you would like to know exactly what we're doing and how we're doing it, go now to www.getstartedwithus.com. That's www.getstartedwithus.com. Again, that's www.getstartedwithus.com.
Welcome back to the show, National Bugle Radio. And so, William, you had some time to think about that answer to the 1996 election question.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely, you know, both the oligarchs, which we know so well, their position of taking over, and also some of the generals who supported Yeltsin, they really urged him to postpone the election. You know, basically not have an election because they were fearing that Yuganov, who was sort of fake, referred to him as a right-wing nationalist leader of the Stalinist Communist Party, would win. And so, you know, talk about interfering with elections. I mean, under the Clinton administration, I mean, there was people sent to Russia to ensure that Yeltsin was elected president. A lot of American money, a lot of advisors were sent there to really push for him to be elected. I mean, even if you read the newspapers at the time, there was a lot of Russians had no confidence in him because the conditions in the major cities, St. Petersburg and Moscow, I mean, there were people, you know, literally starving to death under his very chaotic rule. And so, I mean, even Time magazine, I remember seeing a big article on the front page, Yanks to the Rescue, was a big spread on a Time magazine cover. And so this was basically
the HBO movie Spinning Boris about that.
Yeah.
Spinning Boris with Jeff Goldblum.
This was a complete overthrow. And it was to make sure, as the Clinton administration and other people in government said, to make sure that progressive elements would and progress would continue in Russia. And of course, you know, we know that how this ended up, and with Yeltsin sort of naming his successor, which was Vladimir Putin, which not too many people knew, and the
oligarch. Yeah, but that wasn't really until what, 1999?
91 or 90 was that?
Well, there was a 96 election that was for Yeltsin's second term, then the 2000 elections were coming up. He had gone through a number of prime ministers. Yevgeny Primakov had been one of them who was a diplomat, somebody I thought was actually probably a pretty good diplomat, but he was a Jewish individual. There was another Jew, I think with a Ukrainian last name. There was Viktor Chernomyrdin, who had been one of Yeltsin's earlier prime ministers for a few years, and then he had a comeback. So he was kind of going through a lot of prime ministers as his own personal popularity was plummeting, and then brought in Vladimir Putin. It almost seemed, from my perspective, seemed almost as like a kind of a Hail Mary.
He also felt that he had connections with some of this military infrastructure. By being a member of the KGB and, you know, basically a part of the military. And so they were hoping that he could be a bridge and would quiet some of these people who were very, you know, were feeling that Yeltsin had completely dropped the ball. The thing that we know is that Putin turned out not to be as pliable and did not follow the orders of the oligarchs to a T. He basically, when they approached him and said, here's the big book that we gave to Yeltsin to show you how the government needs to be run, he pushed it back and basically said, look, here's the story. You can keep everything you've stole, but from now on, you're going to have to pay taxes. And this was a very bold move for someone who was in, at that time, a very precarious. A lot of people say, like, well, he just fell into the whole mold. Well, you have to understand just how vulnerable Russia was at the time. There wasn't a lot of options on the table. And so until Putin actually gained the confidence through a variety of incidences of the Russian people, he really couldn't have just cleaned house. You know, he didn't have the power. He didn't have the confidence of the people, and the structures were still pretty much up in the air. I mean, there was still a chance that Russia was not going to make it. So until he consolidated more power under his belt, which took 2, 3, 4 years, he pretty much had to sort of play it by ear. And I think that's, you know, we have seen what has happened since then. And I think at that time, when they did the little switcheroo and Medvedev took over as president, there was also a letdown among the Russian people of saying, this isn't the type of charisma that we had seen in Putin, the passion. Medvedev continued to do these sort of fence-sitting things during a time when it was extremely critical that Russia take bold moves to preserve their economic and political existence. And so a lot of people would say that, well, Putin and Medvedev were very, you know, they were like a pair. Mm-hmm. But if you actually look at it, that was... basically, they didn't have a lot of options given to them by the globalists, mm-hmm. who really thought that Russia was on the ropes and was there for the pickings. I mean, the unipolar world had appeared, and the multipolar world had crumbled. And so there wasn't a lot of options until Putin took the lead and started bringing a degree of confidence, a degree of betterment of the people in the street, and also took the first steps to reestablishing a more stable economic environment. Mm-hmm. And he even said, there was an interesting during this period of time, people were saying, well, you know, what we need to do is have full democracy. You know, that's the only thing that's going to save Russia. But Putin, you know, came out with another form, and it was given a name in Russia that meant, translates to sovereign democracy. And he said that, you know, and a lot of people screamed, like, you can't add an adjective to democracy. It's either democracy or nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what Putin said was, you need a strong sovereign to get us through these extremely difficult times, you know, the 90s and, you know, 1990, 2000, 2003, and 4. You know, we need to have a strong sovereign to deal with one of the biggest problems that they faced was this entrenched corruption within the post-Soviet government. And Putin did a lot very quickly to rout that out,
mm-hmm.
because until that was routed out, there was not going to be progress on any level. And he said back then, he said, this sovereign democracy, he didn't use that word, but other people in the, you know, the Russia First political groups said, that's what it is.
Yeah.
We need to have this sovereign democracy first. And Putin said afterwards, once we gain a degree of political stability and a degree of social betterment of the people in the streets, we can start talking about making the president less powerful. And that's what he did in these proposals,
mm-hmm.
For changes in the Constitution, was saying we have reached a level of political and economic stability, and now we can make the choice of at least the prime minister, we make the choice more representative, so that these regional governors and regional representatives to the Duma will actually make the choice. And that is moving away from this more powerful sovereign democracy to a type of representative government that, a republic like we would feel is representative.
Okay, so before I go on to my other callers, I do have one last question for you. So, you know, I mentioned that under Yeltsin you had Evgeny Primakov, who was Jewish. I thought he was a very capable diplomat. The other Jewish prime minister was Sergei Kiryenko, who wasn't prime minister for very long, and apparently is still serving under Putin as a deputy chief of staff or something like that. I don't know much about him. And, you know, I want to know if people are Jewish or have Jewish ancestry or not, but I'm not going to judge them based on it. And, you know, for instance, you got President Zelensky in Ukraine, who seems to be an improvement over the previous president, who I initially thought
maybe.
Was. Yeah, maybe.
Well,
we'll see. We'll see. I have an open
mind. Of course. Yeah.
And the new prime minister, how do you pronounce his name?
Mushtasin?
Yeah.
Schutzen.
He, you know, the day he was appointed, I looked at Wikipedia and they said his father was Jewish. And then I look today and they say his paternal grandfather was part Jewish. So whatever. We'll see. We'll see how he really acts. But even then, you get people in Russia like Vladimir Zhirinovsky, who was half Jewish and yet is like kind of the most famous anti-Semite in Russian politics. So you never know. But what do we know, before I go to the other callers, Mushtasin, how does he seem so far?
Well, I think he's sort of a representative of a new type of prime minister that Putin talked about. A prime minister that would do more, and Putin was very impressed with what he did by modernizing the tax code, and even he's gained a lot of support from the business community. They at first thought, oh no, here's going to be a computerized tax bureau that will just increase the number of audits, and it's just going to be a nightmare and higher taxes. But actually what he showed was that, tax revenues have gone up 20%, but taxes have only gone up 2%, and much of the business community now applauds him for making a great simplification. I mean, the number of audits have just dropped. I think that instead of 1 in 10, it's like 1 in 4,000. Mm-hmm. So the business community really seen that here is a technician who really got something under his belt.
So
it took him 10 years.
Fewer audits, but he's still bringing in the revenue? Is he bringing more revenue with fewer audits?
Well, he's bringing in more revenue by making it easier mm-hmm. for people to file their taxes. Because many outside of the larger cities were just not on the tax rolls. There was no way that you could find out how much they were making, how much they should be taxed. And so even those people have seen that this wasn't, they were fearing that this was going to be another centralized computer, monstrosity out of Moscow that would just make their lives, would just basically milk them for everything they're worth.
Yeah.
But actually, if you actually see how much simplification has happened and how easy it is, it actually brought a lot of people onto the tax rolls, and they saw a direct correlation to their taxes and improvement in their local infrastructure, because one of the things that he did, and this was under Putin's direction, one of the things he did was, hey, when you collect taxes out in the rural areas, mm-hmm. a portion of that money must go to improving the situation in that area, and he has been very successful. So a lot of people have a lot of faith, and one of the things that he did right off the bat was he said, what my job is to put these new policies into play that are now They are called in Russian, they're called like patriotic works. Like these are works that are not facing outward, but mm-hmm. facing inward to Russia to improve infrastructure, medical coverage, support of the aging, everything. And he said that's his first priority. And if you look at some of his appointments.
Imagine that.
Yeah, what a concept. I mean, I've never heard
imagine
anything like that.
What a
before.
Revolutionary idea.
So anyway, that's my take on him, and also, like I say, there's a lot more that went on. There's some very major changes, but we can maybe go into that at a later date.
I'd like to. Okay, well, let's try to set something up. Thank you so much for your call, William.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, and we'll go on to Paul from New Jersey. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hello, Patrick.
Hello, Paul.
You sure William didn't want more time?
I indulge him because I'm very interested in the topic, and he is our go-to guy on it.
Okay. Hey, listen, Jeremy, he's a good guy and all, but I have to admit, the topic about Kobe Bryant's plane crash to me isn't a big issue, or a helicopter crash, because the fact of the matter is I can't get over the fact that he's a rapist, and I'm very disappointed hearing white men, not trying to capitalize off pointing out the degeneracy of, first of all, sports fans, but also the culture at large that forgives this obvious rapist.
Yeah. How obvious
for
was
his
it?
Crime?
Refresh my memory.
What's that? Well, I urge you all to go to the Daily Beast. They have a really good article about that rape case because it is 17 years ago when it happened. And, when he raped that 19-year-old girl in the hotel room, he left choke marks on her neck. And so that shows you he's a really weird dude. And she was, when he was choking her, she was saying no, no, and trying to fight him off. But he's a pretty big guy, and he had her by the throat. And he even insulted her after the rape. Calling her not that attractive, and then he paid her off, and maximum in the state of Colorado at that time was, I think it was in Colorado, was $2.5 million, so she probably just took the money to not go through the court trial. And, you know, that's the way you do it. You pay off the victim. The victim won't testify. Case closed. And he got away with rape. Now, we have to remember when white men, and you know how we always hear about being based in everything, right? Back 100 years ago, that would have been a hanging offense for raping a white woman.
And was the woman white?
Yeah, she was. She's a 19-year-old girl. And she was, you know, you could tell she was not the most chaste or well-behaved girl, typical modern girl.
She went up to some athlete's room in his hotel room. I wonder what she was going up there for.
Well, she was. I know, but let's not blame the victim here, because the behavior of the criminal, as in the case of paying off the $2.5 million, as in the case with Trump and Bill O'Reilly, when you're paying money to the victim, you're guilty. It. And my point is, we white men out there should be at a higher standard. And, you know, I ever since 2003, I never liked sports. I never want, primarily, I'll admit it, I don't want to give black athletes any money. These men are spoiled, arrogant people, and by whites, you know, worshiping their Negro sports stars, it really is the ultimate in cultural degeneracy, because we have to remember that blacks, by their behavior and by the archaeological history, are unable to build or maintain decent civilizations. That's been proven.
Here are a couple of proposals I would make. First of all, I think there should be no athletic scholarships given out by colleges. And another thing is, I don't think municipalities, state governments, local governments should subsidize stadiums or subsidize sports teams in any way. Those are a couple.
I also believe sports should be taxed, going along with Greta Thunberg, because you know, it's bad for global warming. So why not? You know how you okay. You know how you politicize it. You know how these people do it. It's kind of like why. You know, people like Oprah Winfrey, remember, she politically targets whites by trying to get people to be vegetarian. So therefore, you're going to boycott rural white farmers and put them out of business because you're not going to eat the produce of their ranches. So my point is, I'm just disappointed. I've always been disappointed with white sports fans. Once I read about the black crime rate and just the pathologies of blacks, so I don't want to make them any richer, or unless they're actually maybe at a decent job, like a noble job of repairman, carpenter, mechanic, or whatever, if they're competent in that field. But these men are the most degenerate, spoiled babies, and all white men should shun sports.
Yeah,
unless
I go along with you there. The idea that people who can shoot the basketball through the hoop or whatever, in whatever sport it is, that they should be getting these mega billions and then be whining about things is ridiculous. And we shouldn't be bringing large numbers of them into academic institutions that they have no business in. That's actually a really big problem there. But I've got another caller I got to get to before the show ends.
All right. Very good.
Thanks for your call, Paul. Okay, and next we have Lenny from California. Lenny, welcome to the show.
Yes. In examining what your recent caller just said and looking at paying off the victim, well, what about the $50 billion that Trump just offered to the Palestinians?
To the Palestinians.
How is that for paying off the victim?
Yeah, I mean, that is an offer that's kind of like a fantasy. You know, it's the deal that you know, in The Godfather, I say this is I'll make you an offer you can't refuse. This is an offer they can't accept. So I mean, there's no
in
chance.
In fact, it's not a deal at all. Is it?
Hmm?
Yeah, in fact, it's not a deal at all. Hell, I look at it as the steal of the century, not the deal.
Yeah.
All right? But that what he was saying about Kobe Bryant, yeah, Kobe has his faults, but it's not like Kobe lied about weapons of mass destruction, invaded a country, and had millions of people killed.
That's absolutely true.
All right. And going back to your other caller before that and about the Russian thing, I'm a big admirer of Vladimir Putin, but I was wondering if he was aware that Boris Berezovsky was dating Yeltsin's daughter at that time when Yeltsin won the election from that so-called supremacist guy. If he was aware of that, Boris Berezovsky was dating Yeltsin's daughter and was physically beating her and having her have Yeltsin sign over a lot of the Russians' national treasures and a lot of the industries in his drunken state.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know William and I were. I wasn't familiar with the relationship between Berezovsky and Yeltsin's daughter, but we're very aware of these small oligarchs, most of whom were Jewish, were able to abscond with the Russian state assets, you know, the oil companies, the gas companies, all sorts of, you know, banking and industrial interests, while Yeltsin was, you know, drunk and being propped up from the outside by the United States. So it's, but
exactly.
You know,
and
yeah,
exactly. I'm sorry to cut you off, but I just want to get this in. If he's seen it, and I'll recommend it to you also, but if it's still on YouTube, it's a video called Putin versus the Oligarchs. And when he did bring the hammer down on the likes of Boris Berezovsky, Mikhail Khodorkovsky or whatever, three of them did get to make it flee to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they caught Khodorkovsky, but Berezovsky made it to England. All right, but Putin did, and in this video you will see that they were actually teaching the young Russian children American history, not Russian history. They had changed the entire curriculum of the school system of history, of the Russian history.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, so, and also the old system, if you went to Russia or the Soviet Union, say, in the 1980s, because I did, and young people wouldn't say, oh, who's your favorite rock band? They'd say, who's your favorite poet? Who's your favorite composer? You know, after the fall of the Soviet Union, then it's all Hollywood movies and whatnot, punk rock. And
yes.
Well, thank you.
Yes,
thank you, Lenny.
That's what we all should be saying.
Okay, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another exciting episode of National Blues Radio with Mark Dankoff.
Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. While we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country, here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org, and click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on our online store or call us.
800-724-2719, extension 3. 800-724-2719, extension 3.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.